Next case is 05998, Carolyn Robinson versus Helen Bates. I should advise counsel in the next case that the city is going to be testing its emergency siren system, and we're not sure whether the sounds will penetrate our fortress here, but if it does, it's nothing more than, supposedly nothing more than a test. Mr. Karp.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May I reserve, attempt to reserve 2 or 3 minutes for rebuttal?
Watch your time there in the clock.
Thank you. I'm Marvin Karp. May it please the court. The principal issue before the court today, which is whether or not plaintiffs in personal injury cases can recover as compensatory damages portions of medical bills that were written off by the medical service provider, is an issue that has perplexed virtually every appellate court that has had to wrestle with this issue in recent years. And in virtually every one of those cases, there's a majority opinion and there's a dissenting opinion. And I think that one of the reasons for the difficulty that the courts have encountered in dealing with this issue is that some judges, like the judges of the First District in this case, have entangled two separate concepts which really should be kept apart. Those concepts are, first, how do you measure the reasonable value of medical services in a personal injury case? And the second is the collateral source rule. I'd respectfully suggest if we avoid entangling those two concepts, if we keep them separate, then the resolution of this issue becomes much easier. Therefore, let's just look first at the first concept, which is how do you measure reasonable value of medical services in this day and age? By looking at the initial bill that was sent out by the medical service provider, or by looking at the amount that was accepted by the medical service provider as payment in full.
Let me ask you a question on that in terms of evidence at trial. One of the examples given in the case was a medical bill of $108,000 that was written off and settled at $12,000. Would the plaintiff, if we accepted that the plaintiff could only recover what the plaintiff actually had to pay, if we took that position, the more restrictive position, could you still introduce the fact that the entity billed you for $102,000 because the write-off may be a purely economic issue and not related at all to the fact that they got $102,000 of services, and it could be totally misleading to a jury to see $12,000 being submitted and think, oh, the injury wasn't serious. So is there a difference?
I'm having difficulty, Justice Stratton, hearing what you're asking me.
Okay, let me try this again.
Yes.
You have a bill for $102,000 in one of the examples that was cited to us, one of the cases,
yes,
written off for $12,000.
Right.
If we accepted the more restrictive position, we would only allow recovery for $12,000.
Yes.
Would the plaintiff be permitted, if we took that position, to introduce the fact that $102,000 was actually billed initially as representative of how serious the injury was and not some economic decision for $12,000?
Oh, I suppose you could formulate it in a certain way and appropriate instructions to the jury. You could handle it in that way. Now, in the question I posed a moment ago, I said in this day and age, because I think it's manifest from the cases, and particularly from the amicus curiae brief filed by the Ohio Hospital Association, that nowadays virtually nobody pays the amount of the initial bill. The amicus brief of the Ohio Hospital Association said that 100% of its members enter into, it's 100% of these hospitals, enter into agreements with insurance companies or other third-party payors, which agreements established negotiated payment rates for particular types of medical services.
But shouldn't the General Assembly then take notice of that in 2317.421?
Well,
I mean, if that's the practice, if that's the industry, then the statute seems to be out of sync. But we
sure
have a statute here that says the bill that the doctor submits to the patient is prima facie evidence of the value of the service. I mean, let's say a lawyer sends a bill to a client, and the client only pays 3/4 of it, and the lawyer decides, well, Okay, that's fair enough. I'll write off the rest of it. The value of that lawyer's services hasn't changed, has it? I wouldn't think so. I mean, well, most lawyers would probably say, you still got full value of my services.
You made several points, Mr. Chief Justice. Let me hope that I can pick them all up. The first is, sure, 2317.421 is out of sync. It was enacted in 1970, and we didn't have this type of reality that we have today where nobody pays the initial amount of the bill. Nobody.
I challenge you on that. If
yes.
You're private pay, you do pay. You don't get the price.
That is true. Other than a private payee, that situation, you may not get your discount. That is certainly correct. But other than that, 90% or 95%, it's being paid by different amounts depending on who the payor is. It's like going into an automobile showroom and you see a sticker price on a car. That car sticker price in the automobile showroom is simply the starting point for negotiations.
But there's no statute that says anything about evidence in that instance. I mean, we've got this statute. The General Assembly has said the bill will be prima facie evidence. So you can challenge it, obviously, but how do we just write that off the books?
The legislation, which was passed in 1970,
right.
When
it's
we're
old.
Dealing with a different situation, was simply done to make the presentation of evidence simpler. You didn't have to call in an expert. However, the statute also says that bill is admissible as prima facie evidence if otherwise admissible. If otherwise admissible. And we say it should not be admissible under these circumstances because what it does is it enables a windfall to be created, to be collected by a plaintiff for an amount that nobody ever paid.
Well, counsel, wouldn't admissibility really be turn on relevance?
All right.
Okay, and you're saying that the amount of services rendered are irrelevant?
No, I'm saying...
Why is the amount paid more relevant than the amount paid by a third party?
The services, first of all, were services that were rendered. We have no question about that. You set a broken arm, you set them up in a hospital, et cetera. The question is, what is the measure of the reasonable value of those services? We say the measure of reasonable value is the amount accepted as payment. It's not some amount that was put forward an initial bill to serve as a start of negotiation. No one paid it. Nobody's liable for it.
But that's what's the purpose of the bill, then?
I beg your pardon?
What is the purpose of the bill if it's not to set the measure of the worth of the services?
What is the purpose of a automobile sticker in the automobile showroom?
You
it says the price of the car is $25,000.
If I have no insurance, if I'm the patient, what is the measure of those services other than the bill that I receive? Why will I be billed that amount if someone didn't say, this is what it's worth?
Precisely, in that situation, we don't have the situation we have here. We do not have a disparity between the amount of the bill and the amount they accepted as payment.
So if I have no insurance, the services are worth $100,000.
Precisely.
If I have insurance and my insurance is able to negotiate 50 cents on the dollar, I pay $50,000.
That is precise.
Same services, to me, they're $100,000 worth of service. To the insured person, it's $50,000 worth of service. Is that what you're saying, identical service?
The identical services and the value differ depending upon the particular case.
But counsel, the scheme that is worked out or the payment structure or however else you want is between the provider of services, the hospital and the physicians, and the provider of dollars to pay for that, the insurance companies, the state, whomever.
Yes.
Why should that side agreement impact the value of the services to the injured party and therefore the value to be presented in a contested trial?
The several courts have stated, and I cite Judge Sykes dissenting in the Ellsworth case of Wisconsin Supreme Court, Chief Judge Moon of the Hawaii Supreme Court in the Bynum case said the measure of the reasonable value it doesn't depend upon what the hospital may have been able to charge and collect from somebody else. It is what they were able to accept, what they accepted as payment in this particular case. There's a very recent case decided by the Fourth District, which the court may be unaware. 3 weeks ago, the Fourth District, which is in Highland County, in the case of Gustin against Cheney, and that's 206 Ohio 1049, which went off on the followed the collateral source rule, but what the majority, again, a 2-to-1 case, said I thought was very instructive in this regard. They said the root of the problem lies with medical providers charging inflated prices for their services and then striking a bargain with insurance companies to accept a lesser amount as payment in full for those services. Undoubtedly, the lesser amount paid by the insurance companies is more reflective of the true value of the services rendered, and we agree with that. They said, however, we accept the First District's holding that the collateral source rule kind of trumps this whole situation, and therefore we allow the plaintiff to recover the full amount. Now, of course, the collateral source rule really has no application here at all. The collateral source rule simply holds that a defendant cannot reduce or obtain a credit for a payment that the injured plaintiff received from a third party. It has nothing to do with establishing the amount of the damages. You can't take the collateral source rule and extend that to enable a plaintiff to recover an amount that nobody ever paid. Let me try to illustrate this with a hypothetical. Let's suppose we have a situation in which the injured party gets a medical bill of $10,000. She has an insurance company, and an insurance company comes in and negotiates and gets payment of $5,000, and the hospital accepts it. That's where we are. Now, all of a sudden, however, the defendant pops up and says, whoops, wait a minute. That $5,000 was the amount that was also paid by the insurance company. Therefore, you should deduct that amount, which means that the plaintiff gets zero. At which point, the answer is no. That's where the collateral source rule applies. The collateral source rule says you can't get a deduction. You can't get a credit.
So eliminating the collateral source rule from this case, by eliminating the collateral source rule, what is it you want us to write in this case as the measure for the reasonable value of services?
Fair question, Justice O'Donnell. What we want the court to write in this case is to say that the measure of the reasonable value of medical services is the amount accepted as payment by the medical service provider, period. That answers the question.
But that would contradict 2317.
No. 2317 is simply a rule for the presentation of evidence. 2317.421, is that how the rest of it goes, simply states that in order to prove reasonable value of medical services, you can put in the bill. You don't have to have somebody from the hospital come in and testify it. But it says that's prima facie evidence that can be rebutted. But it also goes on to say, if otherwise admissible, we say it messes things up to put in your situation. $12,000, whoever it was that put it to me, $12,000 is the amount of payment, the actual bill is $100,000. You don't put in the bill for $100,000 because nobody ever paid it, nobody ever incurred any liability for it. It doesn't do anything other than perhaps to indicate that the damages, injuries of this particular plaintiff are very severe.
Here the amount that, I might have to make sure I understand, here the amount that was actually paid by the insurance company was not, was that allowed in evidence or not? Was that admitted?
The judge, yes, what went into the evidence was the amount that was actually accepted as payment. And that was the measure of the damages. The judge held that the plaintiff could not put in the evidence the amount of the original bill, which was a higher amount.
Your argument, though, really falls apart when you consider the fact that if somebody had no insurance, they'd have to pay the full amount.
How does it fall apart? In that particular situation, that is the amount.
You're confusing, it seems to me, the reasonable value of medical services with the economic realities of reimbursement. That is a whole different problem. I mean, for example, my dentist has dental coverage, but he tells me we don't cave in like the medical providers. We don't cave in. You pay the difference. They'll pay 50% of your bill. You pay 50% or you go to somebody else. Now, because my insurance company only pays 50%, does that mean his reasonable value is really only 50%?
No, if you are liable for that amount, you have suffered damages in the amount of that bill and you're entitled to recover that full amount. There's no question about that.
You are putting the value of a negotiated settlement as the reasonable value of services rather than what was actually performed. It seems to me you're mixing those two apples and oranges.
I'm saying only in those situations where you have negotiated a particular amount. In that situation, that's what controls.
So in the example that I cited of $108,000 being negotiated at 12, they only got $12,000 worth
precisely.
Of services?
Precisely. If you're unable to negotiate that and you had to pay $108,000, or if you get a bill and the hospital is chasing you for $108,000, that's your damages.
So the jury is going to believe that he only suffered $12,000 worth of injury, and that's going to dramatically impact what the jury thinks of the extent of the injury, don't you think?
Not really. You measure what the damage is. How are you going to measure the damages in terms of pain and suffering? That element is still there, isn't it?
Well, counsel, would you let the information in that it was originally $102,000, and we settled for 12 if you weren't going to use the hospital bills? In other words, if you had the treating physician that rendered the services.
Yes.
And in the course of describing what services were rendered, what the patient's condition was, and the extent of the injuries, and then the attorney said, well, how much did you charge for this segment of the treatment? And the physician responded, you would object?
No, not necessarily. As I said, these things, it seems to me, these variations as to how you use this in order to demonstrate the severity of the injury to the plaintiff could surely be worked out, and a jury can be appropriately instructed. I've got no problem with that.
When so you're saying you don't have any problem saying that the full value, she was billed $102,000, but only $12,000 was paid by insurance.
No, I don't want to say it that way.
Okay,
how
is that different if the scenario I just said, if you incrementally build up the cost of treatment by questioning the physician? How much did you charge to set a broken arm? How much do you charge to, you know, remove a spleen? All those sort of things. And then you have a cumulative number.
I'm saying that if you want to make the argument that somehow or other this evidence is germane to demonstrate the severity of the injury to the plaintiff, there are ways in which this can be constructed and put into evidence, so long as the jury is instructed that in terms of the medical payment, portion of the award, that whatever going to award, that the amount that they can award is the amount for which was paid.
And now, aren't you, okay, you're never mind.
Could I say it in an opposite way? Are you saying that a bill is never evidence of reasonable value?
No, not saying that at all.
Well, a bill that is negotiated.
And if it's successfully
negotiated. If it's negotiated, you're saying the bill is
then
not.
Then what goes into evidence is the amount. I beg your pardon, I didn't mean to interrupt you, Justice.
To say if the bill is negotiated to a lesser amount,
yes.
You're saying the original bill is not relevant to reasonable value.
That is correct.
Well, counsel, what you really want is just an instruction to the jury saying, even though it may have cost $12,000 or $102,000, you cannot consider that, and you can only consider $12,000 in awarding fees.
Yes.
So you're not really arguing for the total exclusion of a bill. You want a jury instruction that is going to mandate that the jury can't consider the amount in excess of the payment to the hospital.
Sure. The result is the same thing. Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Karp.
Yeah. I do have one other different assignment of error, but I'm probably pretty close to out of my time.
Yes. Yeah, so we'll probably bring that up in your rebuttal, in 30 seconds of rebuttal. Mr. Best.
Thank you. Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. It's my honor and privilege to be before you today representing the appellee in this case, Ms. Carolyn Robinson. And with me is Paul Flowers for the Ohio Academy of Trial Attorneys. Basically, we urge this court to affirm the First District Court of Appeals decision on two issues, the first of which you heard from opposing counsel, and that was what amount of a medical bill is allowed to be introduced into evidence and what amount is allowed to be compensated or brought by the plaintiff. And then secondly, is the Landlord-Tenant Act, whether a landlord that's in violation of a statutory duty under Ohio law has the defense of the open and obvious doctrine. For basically three reasons, the appellee in this case believes that the Robinson opinion was directly on point concerning the collateral source issue. First off, the law in Ohio settles this case, basically. Secondly, as you've heard opposing counsel speak about a windfall, if there's any windfall at all, the plaintiff should receive the benefit of her own foresight to purchase health care insurance. And then thirdly, public policy of Ohio supports a First District opinion. Now, when I suggest look at the law, statutory, and case law to decide this, we have 2317.421 directly on point. That statute allows a plaintiff in a personal injury action to submit the medical bills, the actual bill, as a reasonable and necessary medical expense.
Now, Mr. Karp says that that statute was adopted to really to avoid physicians having to take their time to say this is the bill, this is the, you know, this is the services, this is the value, and that's really what the statute does seem to read that way, doesn't it? That you can submit a piece of paper, so long as it's otherwise admissible, to show the value of the services of the physician. What's your response? Should we consider that sort of policy argument?
Well, I think part of that's correct. I think that part of the decision to enact that statute was to allow the evidence to come in. But I think what that statute also does is once it establishes the prima facie reasonableness of those bills, it's up to the defendant to rebut those bills, not with collateral source payments, but with evidence. As the trials that I've had previously, that's when the defendant has a doctor come in and say these charges are unreasonable and they should have been X. That's the evidence that the defendant should use, not these payments or write-offs.
Your argument is that even the amount that was negotiated between the doctor and the insurance company should not be admitted, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Why not let it all in? Let the judge give an instruction to the jury that, you know, this is what the doctor billed, this is what the doctor negotiated, as every other doctor does, so they get their bills paid quickly and all that sort of thing, and let the jury decide. What's wrong with that?
Well, I think it's in contradiction to Ohio law. Basically, if you go as far back as 1869, was the first time the Supreme Court actually referenced the collateral source rule without naming it that. In that case, the court found that although these medical bills had been paid by a town trustee, yeah, that was totally irrelevant. That bill was totally paid for by the time that case made it to trial. Yet the court found that the plaintiff was allowed to recover that amount. The case of Oliger versus Toledo.
Let me just ask you, if the plaintiff recovers full value for the medical bill and it was negotiated at 50% or 50 cents on the dollar, is the plaintiff then obligated to pay the remainder of the other 50% of that bill to the hospital, or do you consider the negotiated amount between the hospital and the insured or insurance company as a done deal, and that is truly then a windfall?
Well, I think it's a done deal. I think it's a windfall. I think, again, that if any benefit occurs out of any type of personal injury action, especially in Ms. Robinson's case, where she had the foresight to purchase private health
insurance.
What
happens if it's not private insurance? What happens if it's government insurance or government indigent care that's paying the hospital bill?
Well, I still think that is a benefit of having that insurance provided to you. I think it's a benefit of that coverage.
So that excess shouldn't go back to the state?
I don't believe so. And again, you look at the subrogation.
Where's the public policy in that?
Well, most of these statutes or most of these providers have subrogation anyway, so the state's going to get their money back. Again, whenever you look at public policy considerations and you take, for instance, 2315.20, which is the new Ohio statute on the collateral source rule, that establishes that collateral source rule is very much alive in Ohio because that recent statute says that collateral source payments or benefits do not come in unless there's no right of subrogation at all. And so if three things are met, if you have a statutory right, contractual right, or federal right of subrogation, those benefits do not come into evidence. And I think the legislature went even a step further and said those very rare circumstances where there's no right of subrogation and the defendant chooses to bring those collateral source payments in, the plaintiff can then rebut that.
Is this really a collateral source payment? I mean, the collateral source rule is written where someone is reimbursed. There's no reimbursement here to your client. Is there? Just happens. She benefits, and oftentimes this would be an employer's medical plan, not the individual. But there's not a direct payment here, certainly to her, is there? Is this not really different than the collateral source rule as we've created it?
Your Honor, I think the collateral source rule doesn't just mandate payments or doesn't talk about payments. It talks about benefits. And the Ohio cases that we have on point, if you look at Pryor versus Weber, although they were talking about payments made for basically out of time being off work, you look at Succi versus Moore, where the court found that just benefits were not admittable or not relevant on the issue of damages. And if you look at the restatement too, the restatement 920A2 says that benefits conferred on behalf of the plaintiff are not taken account to negate any point or any part of the liability of the tortfeasor. So when if you're discussing benefits, this is clearly a benefit. In Robinson's case, she paid for this. You know, she made her payments for her health care provider, and this is clearly a benefit that should accrue to her and not be given to the negligent tortfeasor.
Generally, in a trial setting, you list your damages that you actually incur, and you're entitled to recovery of those damages. If, in fact, even though the bill was, for example, $100,000 and it was settled out at $10,000, then the actual damages are $10,000. Wouldn't it be a fair rule to write that you could introduce the full value of the bill and all the services were rendered so there's no misleading the jury as to the seriousness of the injury, but when it comes to actual recovery of damages incurred, the $10,000 is all the person would get if that's all they paid. That takes care of this windfall issue, and the damages that are incurred are the damages that are recovered.
I think what you would do in that circumstance is take the benefit away from the plaintiff
receive. But you're talking about a benefit. There's no benefit. There's windfall. I mean, if you had an auto accident and your car was damaged, you can't go and say you have to pay me $5,000 when you only paid $2,000 to have it repaired and get a windfall. You get what you paid to repair it, unless you have a diminution in value argument, and you don't have that here.
I think the Kentucky Supreme Court in the Baptist Healthcare case versus Miller spoke about this issue. And basically, in a recent decision, the Supreme Court found that if you take this benefit or this extra money away from the plaintiff and give it to the defendant, it takes the windfall away from the plaintiff and gives the defendant an unfair advantage. And that court concluded that that was unfair and unreasonable and went as too far to say that in tort law, there's an element of a deterrent effect. Basically, there's no type of punishment for the defendant at all if you take away that benefit of the plaintiff, foresight to purchase or maintain health insurance, and give it to the defendant. Basically.
Go to your second issue, because I'm concerned about, we have a little complication on open and obvious here, because we have an act of repair in progress. And as I read the facts of your second position, your plaintiff did not fall on rubble that wasn't cleaned over that. They fell on part of the retaining wall that still was there in the process of being repaired. That was clearly open and obvious. Address that argument, and why should open and obvious not apply when they're in the actual act of repair under the requirements of a landlord?
Okay. The facts peculiar to Robinson were they tore down the retaining wall and left it. They weren't in the process of repairing anything. They had left the job and quit the job. The landlord testified at trial that he was aware of the condition. He knew of the dangerousness of the condition, yet he did nothing. He instructed the people doing the repairs to put up caution tape and to clean up the area, and they did nothing. He was aware of that. The part of the retaining wall that Ms. Robinson fell on was actually the concrete footer. Where the wall had stood, of course, it was standing or made on a footer. So the wall or part that she fell on was not there before they tore the wall down.
But it was still clearly visible.
It was. She said that it was that she did notice it before. But I think what it goes to the fact of the case was that this landlord was strictly in fault or in violation of 532104.
So you want a strict liability ruling in this case, regardless of any open and obvious defense?
I do not. I think that this is a question for the jury. Duty is established by statute. In this case, what the trial court did was basically take away the duty that the landlord owed Ms. Robinson. This is a jury question. If the jury wants to determine that Ms. Robinson was negligent, then that comes to a comparative issue. Duty is established by statute. Once that duty is established, it's not strict liability. There's still a defense of her seeing it. She's comparatively negligent. But what the trial court did was take that right away from us, and we didn't even make it to the jury trial. It was a directed verdict. But again, on the public policy issue, I'd like to discuss on the collateral source issue. Again, I think the legislature in 23-15-20 established what the law is in Ohio today. And they reestablished that the collateral source rule should apply in cases such as this, whenever there's rights of subrogation. And if we were to accept the proposition of the appellant in this case, it could create havoc for plaintiffs and personal injury actions. First off, plaintiffs, if you believe the appellant, would be looked at different ways. It would depend on the type of coverages that individual had at the time. It would create a myriad of plaintiffs. You'd have a plaintiff with private health insurance, you would have Medicaid, Medicare, and then you'd have the plaintiff with no insurance whatsoever. The amount of coverages that they had would affect the types of outcome that they would be able to address at trial. Basically, what it would do is the first question an attorney would have to ask a client is not so much the severity of your injury, but what type of coverage that you had, because that would directly affect the types of amounts that you'd be able to recover at trial.
Is this an issue that should be covered with a jury instruction and a rule of evidence?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I think that the law as established in Ohio has dealt with this before. Robinson's just a new twist on the old law of Pryor versus Weber and Succi versus Moore. What the appellant's doing in this case is taking the context of what a benefit is and saying there's a difference between payments negotiated and benefits received. I don't think there's any difference between a plaintiff's injury that she sustained a broken arm and sustained $10,000 worth of medicals, or any difference at all that Medicaid only paid $2,500. The injury is the same. The reasonableness of that medical bill is established by statute, and it's up to the testimony of the doctors and the testimony of the doctors the defense wants to put on as to what charges are reasonable and necessary for that injury. Okay. I think the problem that you would have if the appellant's proposition of law is accepted is, once these matters got to trial, many cases would be uneconomical to even pursue. If you had a plaintiff with Medicaid insurance and their amount of medical bills was very small, and in this case, say Robinson, the trial judge never allowed me to introduce the entire amount of the bill. The only amount of bill that I was allowed to introduce was the amount I actually paid. So basically that blindside.
All right, counsel, it seems to me that there's no good, fair result for either side here. You know, at one point, if you limit it to, as the court did, to only the amount was paid, then the tortfeasor benefits. If you allow the entire bill and exclude evidence as to what was actually paid, in other words, don't associate that as being the actual value of the benefit received, then you've got a plaintiff with a windfall. When we have these inequitable situations where there really is no good, I mean, there's rationale on either side that either supports both sides, and obviously there's rationale that would not support either side. Isn't that ripe for legislative interaction and legislative resolve here, and not something that the court need consider?
I agree with you, and I agree that 23-15-20 resolves the issue even more. The legislature should have known of the problem. They're supposed to know public policy in Ohio, and if they do, the public policy spoke on this issue. Basically, the collateral source rule is alive. They never took this into account. Supposedly, according to the appellant, this is a problem that's been here for years, and the legislature has not taken upon themselves to change this fact. Nowhere in Senate Bill 80 did it discuss this, other than to enact a 23-15-20, which basically reestablished the collateral source rule as we've been following since 1970, at least.
If we were to allow both numbers to come in, the amount billed and the amount paid, this is a situation where a jury could sort it out. I mean, the jury, after all, has to determine what amount should be awarded. Would it not be another way to answer the question posed by Justice O'Connor to say that both amounts should go to the jury for their determination and their view of what is the amount of the benefit?
I think what you would do if you allowed that would be to create a windfall problem for juries in general. You'd have to allow discussion of insurance payments, which we know isn't allowable. I think it would confuse a jury. I think it would also lead to more difficult litigation. You would have to have more doctors to come in and testify. Basically, what 23-17-421 did is supposed to make it easier to try these cases and make the cases more open, or make plaintiffs more open for their day in court. And I think if you start talking about negotiated rates, insurance rates, it's just going to confuse the juries even more. It's going to make litigation more difficult, and it's going to make costs more difficult.
Thank you, Mr. Best.
Thank you.
Mr. Karp, you've used your time, but you may take 30 seconds, and I'll start with a question so we get to the second issue that you weren't able to get to. Again, we have this darn statute in the way here, don't we, again? We've got 5321, which establishes a duty on landlords
keep the premises in repair.
Keep all of, and here the trial court didn't give the plaintiffs, either side, a chance to indicate whether repairs were in place. This doesn't, our common law law on this issue doesn't really, the open and obvious, that doesn't defeat the duty that's created by a statute, does it?
No, not at all.
Not on its face, at least.
No, not at all. And we have no problem with that. In the situation where the landlord has failed to keep the premises in repair and somebody is injured, it's negligent per se. But that wasn't the situation here. Situation was here, the landlord tried to make the repairs, was in the process of doing the repairs. As a result of doing this work, they cleared away the falling wall. You had the foundation sitting there, they're ready to put the new wall up, and the plaintiff tripped on it.
Now, why isn't that a jury question to determine whether or not the landlord breached the duty and whether or not open and obvious then would negate that responsibility
the judge
pursuant
held
to the statute?
The judge held a matter of law that it was open and obvious. Conditions were being created here as a result of the repair work. Hence, the statute doesn't apply. You revert to the common law rule of liability. And one of the exceptions to the common law rule of liability is open and obvious. That's what he applied here. That was the situation. We simply say you don't apply the statute.
That's a comparative negligence issue, though, isn't it? There's a duty to keep it in repair, and the argument is The wall was knocked over, and it was left. Parts of it were left there. I thought that was the.
No.
Maybe I'm wrong.
What
well,
they
so
said
we
was there were.
We don't have the facts. We don't. But that's the way I read the briefs, was that there was still remnants of it, and she tripped on this jagged edge.
She tripped on the footer that was there, was not going to be replaced. This is where they're going to put the new wall. That was open and obvious. Admitted. It was open and obvious, and the judge said, since it's open and obvious, this is what controls in this situation. It's a common law obligation. The statute doesn't apply in this situation. That's the rule we're asking for. Yeah. If I may just utilize my 30 seconds, I find 2315.20 is unrecognizable as described by the appellee. 2315.20, which went into effect in April of 2005, essentially obviated the collateral source rule. It permits a defendant to do what the collateral source rule prohibits. The 2315.20 says you may put in evidence of collateral benefits, except if the person who paid the collateral benefit has a right of subrogation. That's it. And then the legislature coupled that with a bill by making statements to the fact that 21 states have eliminated this collateral source rule and specifically urged this court to reconsider it. For them to say that 2315.20 is a legislative embodiment and enactment and reaffirmation of the collateral source rule is just not so. Finally, the matter of, well, she purchased a policy of insurance. True, she didn't buy a policy of insurance, however, in order to obtain a windfall. She purchases insurance to make her, to in essence, be indemnified, to make sure she wouldn't have to pay any money out of her pocket for medical expenses. That's what she got. She didn't buy an insurance policy thinking, wow, if I buy this insurance policy, I'm going to be able to get a windfall from the difference that the insurance company pays and the amount writing off. That wasn't what she bought the policy for. We therefore urge the court to adopt both of the propositions of law that we advanced to the court. I thank the court for its courtesy.
Thank you, Mr. Karp. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.